Hey, folks.
Hello.
My name is Ellen Adair.
And I am Eric Gildy.
And welcome to Take Me Into the Ball Game.
Yeah.
In an effort to bring the entire Take Me Into the Ball Game project into one feed, we are going to be releasing our old episodes on Pitcher List week by week.
Yes. Enjoy for the first time or revisit an old favorite.
And so now, this is one of them. Hello, folks.
Hi, hi.
And welcome to Take Me Into the Ball Game.
Ooh, take me into the childhood wish fulfillment. Take me into the, Silver Linings Playbook before the Silver Linings Playbook?
I mean, I feel like that could be so many baseball movies,
it's
actually.
It's true. It's true. But there is something at work here.
But there's only one that we're talking about today.
Is it a miracle? Is it just in the child's mind? What is going on? Hoo-hoo, ha-ha, we will find out. Or will we? So many mysteries.
We will ask a lot of questions, and maybe we will have answers to some of them. That is Eric Gildy.
Hello.
And my name is Ellen Adair.
Hello.
That's not what I sound like at all.
Why did you say it like that, then?
That's very offensive. It's a very offensive Ellen Adair stereotype.
Ellen Adairs have not worked through the years constantly only for this to happen.
Indeed. Because we are two actors who decided that we would watch baseball movies and grade them on the 20 to 80 scouting scale used for baseball prospects. And so we will not stand for this.
Some of those movies, they're really great. And then we also have other ones.
Yes, and that's why it's good that we have the 20 to 80 scouting scale to apply to them, which, if you're not familiar with it, and improbably, you're just joining us for Tiger Town, we'll go over it in just a little bit.
But first, what are we doing this week?
Tiger Town, like I just said it.
Forget it, Jake. It's Tiger Town. Yeah, just a little reference there. That's fun. Anyway, let's not overcomplicate it any more than we have. We're like 3 minutes into this, and I think we've already headed down about five different avenues. So let's just cut to the chase here. This film, Tiger Town, was welcome to my town, is written and directed. That's the mayor of Tiger Town.
That's my favorite thing that's happened so far. All right, I forgive you for your offensive stereotype.
Thank you. Oh boy. Okay.
It's
so this
just
movie
important that we learn, really. You know? That we just grow as human beings.
This movie was written and directed by Detroit native Alan Shapiro, with additional material by Bobby Shapiro. Bobby!
Hey, Bobby!
This movie originally aired on October 3rd, 1983, just a couple of days after my first birthday. Happy birthday, me. Here's a Tiger Town. On the Disney Channel. Meow. It is actually the first film written and produced specifically for the Disney Channel.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, it's like interesting enough that I mention it. It's not like super interesting, but I appreciate your support in my relaying of that fact. You may also know Alan Shapiro from The Crush, starring Cary Elwes and Alicia Silverstone, or perhaps The Flipper Movie with Paul Hogan and Elijah Wood, maybe the film The Christmas Star. That's what we're dealing with here, folks. And, you know, I'm just going to press ahead. Lights up on Tiger Town. Young boy, young boy Alex likes to go to the Tigers games with his dad, especially to check out aging superstar Billy Young. Pretty soon, however, Alex's dad passes away, leaving him just with his mom and sadness. One day at a Tigers game, though, Alex comes to believe that if he does a sort of deep thinking, meditative prayer type thing that remains vague enough so as not to offend anybody in particular.
He kind of scrunches up his face, too.
He holds his hands together in a kind of prayer, but also a kind of like, gotta hold on because I've got so many thoughts right now. While he's doing that and Billy is at bat, Billy suddenly plays very well. Alex thinks Billy's career and the entire season rests on his shoulders, and he is determined to see as many Tigers games as possible, despite being a child of questionable economic means and who also has school, bullies, and, you know, other stuff to worry about. The great Roy Scheider plays Billy Young, and young Alex is played by Justin Henry. The film went on to have a limited theatrical run in 1984, which coincidentally, or is it, ended up being the greatest season in Tigers history. I mean, 1915 had a slightly higher winning percentage in the regular season, but 1915 did not end with a World Series championship, which 1984 did.
Absolutely did.
Take that, 1915.
It was all of that scrunching of hands and scrunching of face that Alex did. It had a real life effect on the Tigers, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Ty Cobb, Billy Young's got one up on you.
Indeed, yes.
Not a very good postseason player, Ty Cobb. Interesting. To me, you know, that's all I've got for the intro, so let's move along, I guess.
Excellent. So if you are not familiar with the 20 to 80 scouting scale, the first thing to know is that 50 is average on the scale. However, this represents an average major league player, not an average prospect. So if you can find a prospect that you think is going to project to play every day at the major league level, that's actually a good thing.
Yeah. You know, we've already done Cats. I think we did it for Love of the Game. And it was very good and also kind of complicated because we were talking real cats.
There's
we were
so
talking
many
about
cats.
Cartoon cats. Garfield got involved. Oh my goodness, let's not go back there. So let's keep it simple, but in a way that I believe you're still going to have very strong opinions about. Pasta, because there is spaghetti that gets eaten in this spaghetti. And also, there is mac and cheese that goes uneaten, presumably.
Yeah. Mac and cheese that is disparaged unfairly.
I believe so. Yeah. Especially by a little kid. What little kid
doesn't like mac and cheese?
Unless they have some kind of allergy or something that prevents the eating of it. I just don't get it.
I mean,
movie lost me from that point on.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. That is exactly what the entire rest of our review of this is going to be, is that we weren't able to pay attention to anything after the mac and cheese debacle.
Yeah. So I don't know. I usually start out, but I'm going to throw it to you. Do you have a sense of a 50 grade pasta? Are we talking handmade pasta all the time, or is that factoring in also? Is it style plus pre-made versus not pre-made?
I think style plus pre-made versus not pre-made, I think is fair.
Fair enough.
So,
I mean, I kind of just want to say standard spaghetti.
Yeah, but I feel spaghetti is a 50. Particularly, no, actually, I think a 55 is what is it called when it's spaghetti, but there's a tiny hole?
Bucatini.
Okay, that's bucatini. I feel bucatini is a 55, slightly better than average.
Okay, yeah, it's maybe a 60 for me, but okay, I respect that.
That's fair. So in the baseball world, 45, 40, 30, and 20 are progressively less and less good, where 20 is this person does not have this skill.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously in this area, we probably get to the pre-made stuff, especially the old pre-made stuff.
Yeah. And I feel 20 is it's not cooked, but you have to eat it raw out of the box because you're starving.
Yeah. And uncooked or undercooked, the big thick shells or something.
Yep.
Where it's just this is just a mass of starch and sadness, and nobody wants that.
Yeah. Or it what if you just had to eat the lasagna sheets?
Yeah. Oh no, what circle of hell is that?
I mean,
you have to eat the lasagna sheets.
I feel
lasagnifus.
It's one of the upper levels of hell. It's not that bad in comparison to, you know, like being submerged upside down in a lake of fire or ice or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The lasagna sheet eating circle is like not so bad.
The people Virgil's there are
like, the problem here is that we're just separated from cooked pasta.
Virgil's like, okay, so this is this part, Dante. Like, it's not that big of a deal. Like, you wouldn't want to be here, but like, if this freaks you out, like, you're...
It probably did freak him out. I mean, he was Italian.
It's true. Mamma mia.
So in the baseball world, 55, 60, 70, and 80 are progressively better and better, with 80 representing a franchise player or a Hall of Fame talent.
Yeah, I mean, so we get that Bucatini. I mean, for me, when we go up like really high, we get like the Pappardelle. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh.
Pappardelle are so good.
Yeah.
And I mean, to me, any kind of handmade pasta, unless it's poorly made, is like immediately a 70 or an 80.
Mm-hmm.
But I think some of my favorites, I really love orecchiette.
Oh, yeah. And that's the ear pasta.
It's the ear pasta. And like, if we're talking boxed pasta,
mm-hmm.
I quite like fusilli. I feel like it's good, you know, like I actually sort of prefer the ones that are like individual pieces to mm-hmm. the ones that are like long strings like spaghetti, with the exception of pappardelle.
You know what?
But that's because like they're the wideness of the noodle.
That noodle wideness, it's good. It gets all that sauce up. You get that nice ribbony stuff. Yeah.
About wagon wheels. I don't know what the Italian name is, because that's what my mom always called it when we were a kid. You know, she'd be like, I'm making pesto. Would you rather have the penne or the wagon wheels?
That just makes me think of like the Kraft macaroni and cheese, various shapes. And I know that there's like a fancier version of it, but that's what I associate with it. And I'm like, why have a wagon wheel when you can also have basically the same thing, except it's shaped like a dinosaur?
Oh, that's fair. Yeah.
Or like a whatever.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to say that actually a Bucatini might be a 70 for me, because 60, straight, solid macaroni, baby.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, mac and cheese is one thing, but I feel like macaroni as a pasta by itself might even be a 45 for me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Sacrilege.
Yeah. I mean, not mac and cheese, but like if I'm having it with, you know, puttanesca sauce or something like that, I don't want macaroni.
I don't know. Okay. Well,
I think penne are also 50.
Oh, yeah. It might be 55 for me.
But it
Ooh,
might
a
be
good
55.
Big ziti, though. Yum, 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 yum.
Yeah, actually, no. A penne is more like a 55 for me. I like the discrete pieces.
As always, I'm thrilled that we can apply such great precision to our comparisons.
And no doubt make it crystal clear for anybody who doesn't understand the 20 to 80 scouting scale exactly what the intricacies are that like real professional scouts are thinking about all the time.
Yeah, yeah. In some ways, we could almost just say big number good, small number bad. But I feel like there's a nuance that is missed there.
There's absolutely a nuance that is missed.
Mm-hmm.
So we're about to apply this nuance to various tools for the film Tiger Town. And the first one today is amount of baseball.
And what a tool it is. You know, we've got a decent amount of baseball, but like, I don't know how satisfying any of it is. Mm-hmm. That's really ultimately the issue here. Yep. We've got like the game at the top with Dad, and that like establishes the scene. It's very nice. And then Alex goes to a number of games by himself after his dad passes away. That's all well and good. We get different moments. We get playing against different teams, which doesn't always happen in these baseball movies. It's like, why are they always playing the White Sox or whatever? But like, we get a number of different teams in their fun little 1983 jerseys. But despite that, we don't really get good baseball. It's a lot of quick shots of swings. It's all in close-up. Like, we rarely are following games mm-hmm. so much as following, like, did Billy Young, like, crank one out or did he strike out? A lot of tight shots, kind of hard to see the baseball action. Yep. Yeah, so I don't know. I think I'm, like, there's stuff there, but it's not really satisfying. So, like, I feel like I'm at a 45, and that might even be, like, a little on the generous side.
Yeah, I struggled. I mean, for a lot of this movie, it's the kind of baseball that I specifically contrasted the baseball in The Soul of the Game and Summer Catch with. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of like, oh yes, technically this is a baseball scene, but what we got was like a couple of guys tossing the ball in the outfield, or we get like, you know, one semi-implausible Roy Scheider swing and then we're moving on. I will say, because I deeply enjoy slow-mo baseball, even slow-mo fake baseball, that I did get more enjoyment out of the fact that basically everything that Scheider does in this movie is in slow-mo, even like slinging the donut off of the bat. But it made me think
that was good. I really
of
liked
something that.
That
you said about Wesley Snipes in Major League, lo, these many podcasts ago, where him running in slow motion was so that you couldn't tell that he wasn't actually that fast.
Yeah.
And I sort of feel like that probably applies to the baseball performance here.
I think maybe so.
Yes. I'm also here to rule that baseball photos of players mid-baseball action in the credits do count towards amount of baseball,
oh,
but
sure.
Not nearly as much as the actual footage would. So I also kind of want to go 45 because I think that the baseball is so much less satisfying.
Yeah.
But there are 11 instances of baseball, which
sure.
is not bad. So it feels like a question that's like, do 11 raisinettes and chocolate-covered almonds equal a fruit and nut bar?
Yeah. I mean, there's like definitely something there, and it's like consistently there, but it's like, at the end of the day, a little bit smaller and less satisfying than you want it to be. It's like a McDonald's cheeseburger or something. You're like, oh, yeah, I guess that's what
I'm
I ordered.
Like sort of less than you think.
Yeah.
So if I'm to give a 2021 player comp to this, I sort of feel like it's Miguel Cabrera.
No.
Maybe. You know, like, it's like, yay, 11 instances of baseball. And then like, oh, actually negative war. You know, like, it's
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, but at least he had that opening day home run in the snow.
Yes, it's true.
One of the iconic images of 2021 baseball.
Yes, perhaps better than anything in this entire
oh my
movie.
God, I think you're right.
I mean, the other person I was thinking of was Jed Lowry.
Oh, Jed Lowry. I maybe have even said it on this podcast before. I was present at Citi Field during one of his few at-bats as a Met, and I felt like I saw Bigfoot.
You saw a very special thing. You're among a select few.
I took a photo of it, but it was really blurry, and nobody believes that it's real.
Yeah, everybody's like, this Jed Lowry is obviously staged.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just the swamp gas coming up out of Citi Field. So, on that note, I think we're both at a 45. Let's move along to baseball accuracy. So, the central premise of this movie is that I'm going to go ahead and call it The Prayer, even though it's not specifically like religiously affiliated, but I feel like...
I think that's fair.
I feel like non-religiously affiliated prayer exists. So the prayer of a single boy can lift the career of an aging star and get the Tigers to, and I quote, their first pennant in 40 years. More on this in a second. In this movie, I began mentally calling this the angels in the outfield without literal angels premise.
Mm.
Like, and it's always an interesting premise, right? I mean, this is why there are so many movies about this, because like, given the way that even semi-rational adult sports fans will feel like we have changed a sporting event by observing it.
Right. And obviously, like, superstition is a huge thing in sports. And that's why, like, I was thinking of Silver Linings Playbook, is because, like, everybody's got their own thing that, like, goes along with, like, if I do this or if I don't do that, things will work. Of course, you know, this goes all the way back to like ancient battles and all of that. But unfortunately, whatever little superstitious rituals you have, people on the other side have them too. And God cannot favor both sides in war.
Yes, exactly. But I feel like this particular feeling of observation changing something, you know what I mean? Like
sure.
The Phillies have won or lost because I was there.
Yeah. Or because Mabel has been wearing her little dog jersey.
That says real mutt on it. Like real muto, but with just two T's. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for me, I've always felt like quantum physics has proved that observation changes particles' behavior. Because if you, like, take the little tag off of it, then the particle behaves in the way as if it had never been observed to begin with, which is just completely fascinating. So mm-hmm. I feel like this is something that we all emotionally understand on this submolecular level. So I feel like the movie comes out with a strong, like, rhubarb parallel in which Billy Young truly will fail without Alex there to pray for him. I feel like we have the sample size of about half of a season. However, this is the central premise. So I'm bringing it up here, but I am not grading it in baseball accuracy because this is like the raison d'etre of this film.
Yeah. I do think that whereas Rhubarb leaves it a little more open, I think that this movie does, like, and maybe this is just my own bias because I know this is a Disney film, I think that the movie slightly is of the opinion that Alex is right and that his process actually is helping. And I don't know that it is as clear in Rhubarb, because I know that we talked about this very thing in yes. Rhubarb. But one thing that is accurate is that, like, people have these superstitions and believe these things.
Yes.
Whether or not we really can get behind the cosmic rearrangement in the baseball world created by a young child being at the ballpark and, like, scrunching his nose with his eyes closed is, you know, that might never get solved.
Yes. But I'm not ruling on it in baseball accuracy.
For sure.
I'm yeah. giving it a pass. What I am not giving a pass to is A, the rampant lack of consideration for numerical logic and or truth in a number of places, which, like, this is key in baseball. And B, I believe Roy Scheider was 51 when he made this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't have Robert Redford's plausible athleticism. And he's basically like 90% of the baseball action that we get.
Yeah.
So both of those things are problematic.
Well, he's, I mean, like, I think that he is an athletic person. He's got, like, a compact, like, dancer build, sort of, which I think just in his older, like, self, that credibility is just not quite as much there. Because, like, Robert Redford was older for The Natural.
Also true.
But, like, he looked like a baseball player. So even if he looked a little bit older, you could look at him and be like, that looks like a baseball player. In a way that there are baseball players that look like Roy Scheider, but it fits less into, like, a mold, I think, of what you think of as
it's
a baseball player.
It's more his form. Do you know what I mean? Like, Robert Redford's form looks, and I don't mean, like, his body type. I mean, like, his swing and his pitching motion.
Honestly,
not that we see Scheider's pitching motion, obviously.
Well, but honestly, like, this is my thing a little bit, is all of the shots are so tight that, like, I honestly had trouble even gauging what I thought about Roy Scheider's, like, his swing or other movements, because mostly it's, like, shoulders up. Like, if you were, like, taping an audition, you'd be like, pan out, because that's, like, way too tight on you. So I don't disagree, but I'm like a little bit on the fence just because I'm like, I don't know. I guess it must not have been great because, like, we don't actually really get to see it.
It's very hard to actually see.
Yeah.
So the thing that I said I would get to earlier, within the first, I feel like, minute of the film, right? One of the broadcasters says, this team has had a virtual monopoly on last place for some 30 years. So right out of the gate, this is not true. This is not true of the Tigers. And I think it's actually one of the many reasons that at the end of the first time that we watched the film, I was shocked to learn that it was made in 1983 because I just felt like it had 70s written all over it.
It and has a very 70s feel to it.
And I think I was also like, oh, I think I just assumed that we were talking about, like, the mid-70s Tigers, about whom it also would not be true that they had been in last place for the past 30 years, but it would feel slightly more plausible.
Yeah.
Because in 1983, they finished second of seven.
Yeah.
And fourth, third, and fourth the years before that, again, in a seven-team division, like, not remotely last. And so if we're counting 30 years from 1983, going back to 1953... they, in fact, finished first twice, once in 1972 and once in 1968 when they won the World Series.
Boy, howdy.
And also, they literally never finished in last place. Not once, not one time in that 30-year span did the Tigers ever finish in last place. Technically, they finished last in 1952, which is like 1 year more, but like my point still stands.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. This is all research that I did not do because I know that you were doing it. But one thing that I was thinking about is like Billy Young. Like who among us is Billy Young on the you know 1983 or just generally early 80s Tigers? And I don't know that there's actually like a really solid comparison, but there is a solid Detroit Tigers comparison just going a little bit earlier, and that is a Mr. Al Kaline, Mr. Tiger himself. You've got to mm-hmm. be pretty good to be called Mr. Tiger, yeah. Right? So early on in the film, in this same moment where you are talking about like the announcers saying this and that about Billy, they mention that he has 9 Golden Gloves, a .309 lifetime batting average, and 396 home runs. So Al Kaline, his career spanned basically from 1955 to 1967. There was some time in the middle of that he was not playing because of injuries. He had 10 Golden Gloves, 399 home runs, and a lifetime average of .297. So by and large, with the exception of the average, like a slightly better player than Billy Young, which I think is actually kind of a sweet thing for the filmmakers to do. Like he's really good. He's no Al Kaline, but he's pretty good. I don't know that we need to get especially deep here for the purposes of this film, but I will say that Nick Waddell's Saber bio is great. And just a couple of details here. His legendary arm strength is one thing. There was a Sporting News article, I think, that mentioned that Yogi Berra and someone else were like, oh yeah, no, like he had the best arm of any outfielder of that time. When he was young, he was like at a festival of some kind. This is from the Nick Waddell article. He threw a ball 173.5 feet, and the judges didn't believe him, so they made him do it again. And so he threw it again, and the second time he threw it for 175 feet. Also, he suffered from osteomyelitis, which is a bone condition that I don't really know a whole lot about, but it required like bone to be removed from his foot.
Ooh.
And he compensated by learning how to run on the side of that foot.
Oh gosh.
He was crazy tough and crazy determined. And like, for sure, one of the all-time greats who played for Detroit. Billy in this movie had not been to a World Series. That's one of the big things here. Al did, winning on the 1968 team, which was wild because it was beating the St. Louis Cardinals, the Bob Gibson St. Louis Cardinals mm-hmm. that also had like Lou Brock and Orlando Cepeda and Roger Maris in his final year of baseball, in which he was still pretty good.
Yeah.
Kaline died in April of 2020 for undisclosed reasons. His family said it was not COVID related. It was more just like being a very old man related.
Perhaps the best way to die.
Yeah. I believe he's also among the first and maybe the first person whose image appears in the opening montage of the film as an individual. There are some team photos beforehand. And Billy plays right field, which Al played.
Mm-hmm.
And also Billy wears the number 6, which was Al's number, which was retired in 1980. So not accurate per se, but like a nice homage.
Yes. Yeah. It's very clear that the film was sort of trying to pay an homage to him without... I also love the fact that like he wasn't quite as good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
There's one other thing that I just have to mention about the 1968 team that is
Go
just so delightful. There is a player that I want to shout out. The great character of Gate Brown, a guy who spent his whole career on the Tigers. He was frustrated because he often didn't start, like it seemed like he was going to, and then Willie Horton came up and took his spot, and he only occasionally started. And yet in 1968, again, the year of the pitcher, Bob Gibson, like the rules changed after that season, He batted 370.
Oh my.
In 104 plate appearances with only 17 games started and 49 pinch hit appearances. So he batted that well with like a huge percentage of it being pinch hitting.
Wow.
His OPS plus across his career is 110, 13 seasons, but that year it was 234.
Astonishing.
In addition to that, there's one other reason that I wanted to bring this up, which is this story that I think is just so amazing that I couldn't not share it. So there was a day in 1968. This is a story that I found in a Sporting News article by David Kindred from 1994, that there was this day that, as a guy who like mostly just pinch hits and doesn't start that much, he was feeling like kind of hungry and he wasn't going to be needed. So he left the clubhouse to grab a couple of hot dogs. And upon his return, he was ordered by the manager, Mayo Smith, to pinch hit. Gates' solution in that moment, because he wasn't supposed to be out like getting hot dogs, was to stuff the hot dogs into his jersey. Brown is quoted as saying, "I always wanted to get a hit every time I went to the plate, but this was the one time I didn't want to get a hit. I'll be damned if I didn't smack one in the gap, and I had to slide into second, head first, no less. I was safe with a double, but when I stood up, I had mustard and ketchup and smashed hot dogs and buns all over me." He was fined and also laughed at, asked why he did it. He said he was hungry, and where else can you eat a hot dog and watch the game from the best seat in the house?
Oh my gosh, that's so amazing.
Thank you for indulging me. I could not read that and not share it.
I'm almost like, why was he fined? He like did his job well. You know what I mean? Like, be fined if it's found out that you like purposely struck out because you didn't want people to know that you had hot dogs in your jersey.
He had a couple of pocket dogs.
Oh gosh, it's so good. It's so good.
Anyway, here's to you, Gate.
Well, let's imagine that it's a world in which Gate does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
Because in this film, there are no 1968 World Series Tigers.
No.
Because they've been in last place for around 30 years. It's their first pennant in 40 years.
This is the dark timeline for the Tigers.
Exactly. This is the dark timeline. And so if that is the reality that we're living in, I seriously doubt the accuracy of the announcer's remark that the fan base is so loyal that like they're there and then we see them and this stadium is packed. And like, it's not even like this is the Cubs and that's their brand. Like, nobody's putting up with that. 30 years in last place? Like, everybody is so into the game. They're not even just like, hey, we're here to enjoy the atmosphere and have a beer and haha, they always lose. Like, they are into it.
Yeah.
This is a mirror up to no nature that I have ever seen.
This is true. This is true. Although I did appreciate at the very beginning how the announcers were like sort of scolding the fans for booing the crowd. But that also goes back to like, but why would there be such a big crowd booing them?
Right, right. Yeah. Yes. Yes. I was also bothered by the fact that they did a Let's Go Tigers chant, like, let's go Tigers, like a Let's Go Mets chant, and not like a like Let's Go Tigers clap, 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 like you would obviously do. And I was just like, what is wrong with these people?
Like any sane human being.
Like any sane human being. Yes. Like, have these people been drugged and put in the stadium? What's going on? There's also a numerical challenge presented when the announcers say in this early section that the season is half over and the Tigers are in last place by 16 games. So let's have an Ellen Adair breakdown.
Oh my.
Oh my. Let us imagine that they have a record of 33 and 49, which would put them 16 games back of where the Blue Jays were on July 11th, 1983, about the midpoint of the season.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have needed to win 99 games in order to win the division that year. So that means, friends, that they would have to go 66 and 14 over the remainder of the season. Like, that's an 825 winning percentage. That's almost as bad as the 854 winning percentage that the Cubs have to maintain in order to win in Rookie of the Year. But at least that's only over a month and a half and not like the entire back half of a season.
Yeah. That's like an all-time, that's like motivating the rhubarb people talking about the 1914 Braves.
100%. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Legendary.
Legendary. And given that the film posits that they're not necessarily winning on the road because Alex cannot be there to scrunch his face, like, yeah, that's not possible. Mm-hmm. So Alex is like doing his math to be like, well, there's 30 home games left, and so we need to win 27. And I'm like, oh no, my friend, like, if Billy Young is failing on the road because you're not there to pray for him in person, like, you need to win all of your home games.
Oh yeah.
And more somehow.
So, yeah.
Yeah. It's a numerical baseball accuracy problem.
It's true. It's true. I also was a little bit interested in, I didn't really think about the math. I guess it's probably plausible, but I did notice that at the very beginning of the film, Billy is batting 204, and then by the end, he's batting 320, which
right.
just seemed like a pretty solid improvement for what was not necessarily like a huge amount of time. Like, he'd have to be on like a real tear. And when you consider the home and road like splits of like how he's maybe doing because Alex is not at the away games. Yeah, I don't know. There's some funny numbers there, I think.
Essentially, he'd have to hit like 450-ish mm-hmm. to yeah. get at 320.
Yeah, which means maybe even more than that at home games.
Yes. Yeah. 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 It's sort of bananas. So on Billy Young's stats, which we get flashed for a second up on the old-timey Jumbotron, not only does he have a 320 average, he has 47 RBI. And 34 home run. Whoa. Hold on. Like, yes, RBI are stupid as a measure of skill, but as a measure of what happened with this baseball team, how did they get here to first place in the American League with their star player who's doing shaving cream commercials only knocking in 47 runs on the entire season?
Yeah.
Like, and he only hit in 13 people besides himself? Like, how is that possible, given that they have also won that many games? Like, were they all 1-0 games? And if that's the case, this movie is not talking enough about their pitching staff.
Yeah. You know who has a lot of home runs and not very many RBI? Cedric Mullins. And where are the Orioles right now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not winning the American League.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Everybody's all up in arms about Bryce Harper only having 80 RBI. And that's because there were runners on base in like 18% of his plate appearances. But he's hit 33 home runs to this point in the season, and he still has 80 RBI.
Yeah.
Like, this is bananas. I think this is not numerically possible with what the rest of this film is positing.
And I feel like this was also at a time that RBI was held as a more sacred stat, like, obviously, than it is now. And so that is just even more of an argument for that number to be higher.
Yeah. Yeah. It's totally absurd. Although, speaking of Cedric Mullins, it is logical that the Orioles would make sense as the team that the Tigers would be tied with in 1983, as they did win the division that year.
Yeah.
So.
Well, in 83, they won it all, right? Against the...
yeah, don't talk to me about it. I know.
The Philadelphia Phillies. I know.
So there is no way that Alex sneaks into the clubhouse, not even in the 1980s. I almost said 1970s because it feels like the 1970s. There's no way that he snuck into the clubhouse in either of those decades.
That kid is like a ninja.
Yes. Yes.
Except at his school where the hall monitor bully catches him like immediately.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, I have more to say about that in a second. There is no way that he can just hop onto the field and play catch with a star while he's warming up. Like, not even in the 1980s.
Yeah.
I took the note at this point, is this Alex's dream ballet? Like, I was legitimately not sure if it was supposed to be actually happening.
But even earlier than that, like, there are other kids, they're like teenagers that like razz Billy Young, like being like, oh, you should date my sister, or like whatever. And then make a joke about like striking out or getting on base or something. I can't remember, who cares. But the thing about that is, it just feels like Tiger Stadium is just like full of kids just like running around doing whatever.
Yeah. No, like absolutely, there is a security issue
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
in this stadium.
Yeah, I think that this is a Tigers team that really needs to assess where it's at in terms of general security on the premises.
Yeah. So, speaking of the hall monitor catching him, I had a huge problem storytelling-wise with this whole plot line whereby Alex is constantly cutting school in order to go to Tigers games. But I was like, were there more weekday games in the 1980s? And the answer is no. So we know that this movie starts at the midpoint of the season. So even if Alex's school starts back up on like August 15th, some like ungodly day to go back to school.
Sure.
There was not a single weekday game for the Tigers in 1983 from August 15th until the end of the season. There wasn't one. So like this whole plot that he's in trouble for constantly cutting class and like, you know, the bully kid is taunting him about it and he's asking his mom to lie for him. It's like all based on a foundational baseball fallacy.
Yeah. That's interesting. So like no day games during that time.
Only Saturday and Sunday day games.
Oh, wow.
Yep. Not a one.
I don't even know what to think.
I mean, this movie doesn't have a lot of like baseball accuracy is kind of what I'm starting to think.
What? That's wild.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yep.
I don't want to get into it, but I will just quickly say that I did appreciate that the early part of the movie has a conversation between Alex and his dad, where his dad talks about playing baseball in the Navy. That is a huge subject that I am not going to get into here, but like baseball in the Navy is like a huge thing with a storied like past. It helped spread the sport across the world, all of that. I just like appreciated the mentioning of that, even though I don't know that it's like a super like crazy good thing in terms of like weighting positive towards the baseball accuracy score. But like that was a thing that I liked, and I'm going to mention a thing that I liked in a relative desert of other baseball accuracy things. Because most of my baseball accuracy stuff has actually just been like, this allowed me to talk about Alkaline and not actually like the accuracy of the film.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, one positive thing that I can talk about is that Sparky Anderson is in this film.
He is.
The real Sparky Anderson is in this film, and he is still the Tigers' winningest manager of all time, with a .516 winning percentage over a staggering 1,331 to 1,248 games.
Oh, amazing.
Sparky Anderson.
And we had talked even during For Love of the Game, I think, about that 1984 World Series mm-hmm. where it was Sparky Anderson versus Dick Williams. And whoever won the World Series would be the first manager to win a World Series for both an American League and a National League team. It's so cool. Sparky's great. He does a fine job, too, and for yeah, what he's asked
he's,
of. Yeah,
he's pretty good. He's pretty good in the movie. I mean, I have to wonder, was he horrified by all that he saw? Or maybe he, you know, just didn't actually dive into the script too much.
I would lean towards the latter there.
Yes. So that final game, the movie goes out of its way to point out to us that when the man on base in front of Billy Young scores, the score is 3-2 with the Orioles up. And we see no one else score. And then Billy Young scores, and the score should be 3-3, but instead the announcers say that the Tigers have won. Shouldn't the game just be tied? Am I missing something? Like, this is a very large problem. This is not a like, well, actually, the Detroit Tigers didn't have any weekday games, which, like, that's me. I'm that annoying.
That but, was
like,
a really good impression of you.
I know, it's such a harmful stereotype, but still, like, this is a big problem. This mm-hmm. is like, how did nobody... You don't even have to know about the rules of baseball to know that, like, a 3-3 is a tie.
Yeah, that's just numbers.
That's just numbers.
Not even that many of them.
Like, I don't know that much about soccer, but I can tell you that a soccer game with a score of 3-3, that's a tie. You got to go into, like, shootouts or something.
I love how much you know about soccer.
I know. I just, it's pretty impressive. Just try to contain yourself. So, I don't have anything else to discuss. Do you?
No, I think I'm good.
I don't know. I don't know if I'm just cranky today. Like, I don't feel like I can give this a 40 because I don't know that there's like enough positive there to offset all the detractions. So I think, like, I mean, it's somewhere between a 30 and a 40, but I think I'm going to have to go 30.
I totally respect that choice. I'm going to go 40, and I don't feel like that strongly about it, but I'm just going to go 40.
Yeah, no,
but
that's fair.
I get the 30 completely.
Yeah. I think either choice could be justified, but...
Yeah.
Let us move along to storytelling.
Well, you know, there are some things
this
here
is
and
tough.
There. This is not easy, that's for sure. One thing that I'll say that I do really like about this film in terms of the storytelling is the way that the film is like a little bit of a time capsule. Mm. I love all of the shots of like... streets of Detroit from 1983. I love the shots of Tiger Stadium. I love all of that. And okay, so now we've got that out of the way. There's also something to be said about, and maybe this is one of the biggest, like, main things about it, is this whole notion of Alex being able to like somehow affect the outcome of games by being there. And, you know, this is like a Disney film. Again, it's a family film. There is a certain amount of like wish fulfillment in that. And I get that. There's a part of me that sort of feels like if this came out just a little bit later, when I would, because, you know, we were both very young when this came out, like too young really to like sort of appreciate it when it was like on it on its own terms. But like if I had seen this when I was like 6 years old or something, I would have probably thought it was really cool and like been like, oh yeah, like, you know, this is doing all the Disney stuff to me in ways that I like. But I don't know how I feel ultimately about that whole like central premise, which is described by the father a couple of times in his sort of short presence in the film, of just saying like, quote, if you believe in something with all your heart, you can make it happen. Oh gosh, what I wanted to say was, take me into the secret for early 80s kids. And like, that's kind of what it is, this like manifesting stuff if you like care about it or whatever. And like, I don't know. I mean, thankfully the movie is like not super long, so it doesn't like dwell on it that much. It moves along pretty fine and it doesn't drag too much, except for maybe a couple of spots. I don't know. I feel like mostly fine about it on the whole, but like I've been speaking kind of broadly about it. I'd be interested to hear a little bit more from you before I get into other like particulars.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, regards its sort of central premise, the upshot of this film is that this film believes, like, if you really believe deep in your heart, you can make it happen. And for me, I do believe in the power of belief, but I think that it has a limited sphere, and I feel like we don't get to choose how it necessarily shows up.
Like, and it doesn't take the form of, like, greed, of, like, believe and then get stuff.
Right.
Like, I think it's, to my understanding of those mindsets, it's more like, if you believe in this, then you will get like peace or like happiness or whatever. Not like you will get a win for your team or a material possession or something.
Right. But I mean, I just mean, I think about, for example, we see that Billy is wearing a bracelet.
That's right.
And it's his lucky bracelet. And I personally do not believe that a bracelet is lucky. However, you know, I know obviously there's like a great and more recent history of baseball players wearing like some kind of, I can't remember the name of it, but like a jewelry that's made out of a special alien stone or something like that. Like,
sure, sure.
I feel like this was a thing specifically like maybe 10 years ago.
Okay.
And I'm sorry that I can't remember the name of the thing. Anyway, somebody like... at me at Ellen_Adair and tell me what the name of the thing was. So I look at something like that and I'm like, well, the necklace doesn't necessarily have that power. However, if you think I am better now that I am wearing this necklace and I feel more confident and I feel more relaxed, actually that belief does have a power, ends up having a power for you yourself. However, like my belief that Bryce Harper is going to hit a home run, I do not believe that has an effect on whether or not Bryce Harper hits a home run.
Yeah, and it's like a weird storytelling thing that Alex sort of decides or learns, discovers, however you want to put it, that his being present at the game and thinking really hard will lead to Billy doing well and the Tigers winning. It's weird that he calls Billy out on the bracelet and is like, you don't need that bracelet, you just need to believe, you know, like me, the child who thinks that the fate of the Tigers rests on his shoulders. It was like a little bit of a conflicting message, I think, of like, your faith is wrong, but my faith is right, or something.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I mean, I felt two ways about that story point, but I realized that its function was just so that in that final at bat, we can see Billy take the bracelet off and we know that he's thinking about that conversation that he had with Alex.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, we don't know that he has had any thought about Alex again ever since, like, who is that weird kid who somehow came onto the field and played catch with me?
Sure,
like,
sure.
That's actually what I think its story function serves. But I think you're right. I think you're right that, like, that's kind of why it gave me a little bit of a question. Because yeah. I was like, ultimately, we're talking about the power of belief. So whatever it is that you want to endow your belief in will have power for you. Yeah. I mean, again, of course, this is just my belief. And so, like, who am I to say I'm right? However, I will say about this film, I gave almost no thought to this when I was considering storytelling because I felt bogged down in consideration of the more literal filmic storytelling, which is interesting.
Yeah.
In the sort of like, here's my ultimate takeaway. I sort of feel like this might be the worst movie that we've seen on this podcast. And ooh. Yet, it did not make me miserable. It's like the worst not offensive movie. So while I was watching it, I sort of felt like it was a movie that was made from before they knew how to make movies. Like I felt like I was watching like a very...
It's like just like one of those old photos of just like a train going by.
Right. Like it, well, it felt like, no, like not like a silent film. It felt like an early talkie film from before film language is established for like, this is how you set up a scene. This is how much time you need to establish this story point. Like at this point, we are also inculcated in film language that we receive ultimately the way that everybody has decided this is how we tell a film story. We receive the story without even kind of thinking about it.
Yeah.
But like, it sort of felt like a well-funded student film to me. Like the storytelling is so awkward.
Yeah.
And part of the awkwardness is I had this sense that someone was trying to make a quote, long movie out of a short film.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, especially because, you know, if you look at what the movie is and what happens, it's pretty straightforward.
It's astonishingly straightforward.
Like, kid is a baseball fan, goes to games with his dad, the dad dies, kid goes to games by himself for a while, realizes that he can maybe have an impact on the game, and then he does. There are a couple of little obstacles to see that to completion, but like he sees it to completion. That's pretty much it. There are weird, like complex things that don't have to do with the narrative at all that just like slightly confuse me.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
What is going on with this family? Like, I think it would have maybe been clearer if the father, for example, had been like down on his luck or dying.
Yes.
It feels a little bit messy narratively for it to be both.
Right.
Right? Like, at first it's just like, oh, things are tight. Like, oh man, I can't get a job at this like auto plant that I worked at. And that really like sucks. Oh, geez, like don't tell mom that we're getting this like spaghetti at the Italian restaurant. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, I'm in bed. I don't feel well. And now I'm dead.
Yes. 100% on all of those things. Like, I was definitely like, what is the point of the extended shots in the automotive factory? We're so early in the film. We're still like learning what's going on and who these people are. And we spend like, is the car company a sponsor of this film? It was like oddly anthropological.
Yeah.
And
which is like interesting to watch. You're like, oh, this is what a like car factory looked like in the early 80s. Like, there's something interesting about that, but it doesn't actually help in terms of telling the story of the film.
And it literally doesn't make sense, if he has some kind of an illness, why he's trying hard to get a job.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like his problem, as you said, is being out of work and not being sick. And, like, if the point is that we're not supposed to know that he's sick yet because mm-hmm. Alex doesn't know, it's odd then to see inside the factory and see a scene that Alex wouldn't be privy to. Like, Alex isn't enough of a perspectival character in that case to be like, oh, well, the reason that it's a surprise is because it's a surprise to Alex.
And, like, if the dad, like, knows that he's going to die, like, what? Is he, like, going through the motions of this just to, like, make his kid not think that he's dying? Like, it doesn't make any sense at all.
And, like, why is there a long scene in which Alex brushes his teeth and gargles and absolutely no development about his dad's illness? It's literally like, one, we're going out to lunch. Two, I don't feel well enough today. And then, like, three, he's dead.
Yeah. And it's not even just like he's dead. Like, the cinematic storytelling makes it seem like not much time has passed. Like, there's a, oh, I'm not feeling well, so I don't know if I'm going to be able to go to, like, the free hat day or whatever at the stadium this weekend. And then it cuts to Alex coming home. It seems like it's the next day. Maybe time has passed, but I feel like the like, filmic language kind of implies that it's the very next day. And he comes home, and there are 9 people sitting in the living room. So it's not just that he's died, but he's died and people have found out about it. And they're like, I don't know, it's like the whole freaking neighborhood is like sitting Shiva or something. And it makes no sense at all. Like, all of this has happened in like 12 hours.
Yes. And this very awkward, like, lack of development storytelling is juxtaposed by so much stuff being crammed into this movie that we really don't need. Like, it felt like there was a lot of stuff put into this movie to purposefully inflate it to its hour and 15 minute length.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like you could easily get this film to like a tight hour by just trimming away the stuff that doesn't have anything to do with the storytelling.
What's funny is that I feel like there was, in my research, something that I read that was like, when it was released this way, it was actually shorter. And I don't know if the version that we saw was the longer or the shorter version. And I don't know which is better and which is worse.
Yeah, but I mean, there's stuff that I bet is the same in both that still just feels, it almost feels uncomfortable. It's so long, like coming out of the title sequences, that sort of the camera is panning out from the poster of Billy Young. And it's like far too long for the tone of the film.
Yeah.
And like, there's a scene where we watch Alex fall asleep for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or even like at the very end of the film, after the bit, like, spoiler, in this Disney baseball film, there is a victory at the end and they go on to the World Series. But like, after this big moment, the movie ends with this like long, silent shot of the field and like empty stands. And it feels like the sort of thing that you would see like at the end of like a war film, where you're just supposed to have like this space to reflect upon like the darkness of man's heart or something.
Yeah. Like, obviously you end on the shot of the balloons going into the sky.
Yes. But you, like, always do that. Well, not always, but in this type of a film, you do that.
Credits over the balloons going into the sky. Yeah. Like, but instead we go back to like an unnecessarily long shot of Alex's face. And then like, probably allowed to be the last person in the stadium only because they're making a movie. And then like, he walks up into the stands. We don't learn anything. It's not interesting to watch. And then we watch like a different shot of a stadium. Like, why is this interesting? Why are we watching this?
Yeah.
It reminded me, I asked myself the question, is this art? That I had asked of myself about the children singing in Aunt Mary, where it goes on for so long that you're like, I'm uncomfortable. And then it goes on so much longer than that.
Oh God, that lip sync moment. Yes.
Yeah. There were so many things in this movie where I was, yeah, just like, am I sitting on an uncomfortable cube in the MoMA?
Yeah.
Like, what's
happening?
What is happening?
Speaking like when
we find out that the bully kid has stolen Alex's money. One might say a dramatic highlight of the film. Mm-hmm. How will he make it to the stadium? We go to 2 minutes and 15 seconds of B-roll of people like filing into the stadium. It's an eternity. Like, that's the length of a whole scene for what is basically the setup of a scene.
Yeah, it's true.
And I had this question, how does a movie get made without a B-plot or the development of its central idea?
Yeah.
And then I realized they are substituting B-roll for a B-plot. Yeah. They're like, our B-plot will be like shots of other people, you know, mm-hmm. like changing the sign in their diner.
I wonder if some of this was just like the fact that this was like essentially like Disney's first made-for-TV film, and maybe they were like figuring this out. I mean, but it's like Disney's made plenty of films. They should know how right. to do this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know that sort of like you've got to have an idea and then you've got to have that idea go somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. One quick thing to circle back to the death of Alex's father and that weird like dropping of that news. When Alex comes home and sees this group of people, it's like Alex has been gone for like a week
yes.
and he has come back in time for the service, but did not realize it. It's very, very strange. It's not Alex's sweet, underwritten mother who tells him that his father has passed away. It's this like random dude who's like, hey, your dad is dead.
Yeah.
And like, we don't know who he is. We've never seen him before. And I don't think we see him afterwards. Nope. Like, why is this guy dropping the news? Why can't it at the very least be his mom? There are ways to do it efficiently. I mean, that's what Little Big League did. Like, he comes home and the mom is like, I've got bad news about grandpa or like whatever. Yeah. I don't even think it's that. I think it's just like a couple of shots and you get it from the storytelling of the shots. And this does like all of the wrong things as far as that goes. It's like amazing.
Yeah, it's quite baffling. What year was Little Big League again?
It's like 94, I think.
That's like 10 years after this film. It feels like it's like 50 years after in the evolution of how we tell stories on film.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I was so mad that they got dinner without the mom. I mean, I felt a little less mad when I knew that the dad was sick, but it was just like rude of them. Like, go home and like tell mom, let's go out to this restaurant. We can have your mac and cheese tomorrow.
Yeah.
Mom was right to be mad. That's how I felt about that.
I agree. There are a couple of weird things that come about through, I don't know if it's meant, I don't know what to make of it. In terms of Alex trying to sort of like learn or have faith in the abilities that he has. Like, there's the moment in the cafeteria after the first game or after like a couple of games where he's like, I can will Billy Young to be good. And he's like staring at his milk carton and like nothing happens. And the other kids are like, very rightly so, I have to say,
yes.
like, what are you doing? And my question is, like, what is Alex trying to do? Is he, like, trying to make his milk carton explode?
I feel like that's is the only he, logical answer to
like,
that question.
And like, why? Like, if you do that, you've got milk all over
right.
you.
Yeah, does not solve any problems. I mean,
this is a lose-lose scenario.
Right. But, I mean, of course, what we learned is that he does not have power over milk cartons.
He only
has power over Billy Young.
Just Billy Young.
Yes.
And then, after that, there's that moment where he, like, predicts that Billy Young will hit a home run in the ninth one time. And when it happens, the mom acts like he's got The Shining or something. It's like, it's not unusual for a kid to be like, no, he's going to hit a home run and win the game. Like, I felt like that was a little bit overblown, that like a child is like, he's going to hit a home run in the ninth tomorrow and win it. And then when that happens, the mom is like, whoa.
Yeah.
This is crazy. Like, I that seemed like a stretch to me.
Yeah, I don't know. There was a lot of confusing stuff with the mom character in general. Like, what exactly her perspective on yeah. it is. just like this moment when she's kind of looking at his notes and she looks happy and wistful. And yeah, it's like the very unclear storytelling around like whether or not she's willing to take him out of school in order to go early to Tigers games that don't actually exist. So,
yeah.
And I was very curious about how is Alex affording all of these tickets? Like, absolutely never discussed.
Yeah.
Especially if we're to believe that his father was sort of like down on his luck at the beginning of the film.
And the mom has no discernible job.
Yes.
Which we can maybe save for another category.
Yes.
But they also live in like what seems to be a pretty nice house.
Yeah. They could just like own that house outright. Fine.
Sure.
But still, then like where's the extra disposable income to go to every single Tigers home game? I mean, I assume that maybe the ticket prices were not as bad in those days, but like it still has to add up.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And I was sort of like, also, why doesn't Alex help anybody else on the team?
Yeah.
Like, if
that
his prayer is so
move.
Powerful, it's actually kind of like limited in his thinking and like maybe even selfish of him to not spread the wealth of his power of prayer around.
This is a team sport, Alex.
Yeah.
Get with the program, buddy.
It also made me kind of sad that, you know, like he has to scrunch his eyes closed. And so he misses witnessing the swing of his favorite player. I mean, not that, as we've discussed, not that like Roy Scheider is out there like Ken Griffey Jr. or, you know, mm-hmm. Pujols or, I mean, like Nick Castellanos or something. But like most baseball swings are objectively nice to behold and he's missing it.
It's like a Greek myth. Like you can make it happen, but you can't
see it.
That is
the price that you pay. Yes, yes. There must always be a sacrifice. Yeah. So when that kid is like, hey, Alex, did you see Young's homer yesterday? And he says, yeah. I was like, that is not true.
False.
False. You didn't see it.
There's so much that we can talk about. I feel like the last like big thing that I want to bring up is like the last, like, I don't know, like 20-25% of the film is him like trying to get to the stadium. It goes on forever. It goes on for so long, especially given the fact that this is a relatively short film compared to a lot of the other baseball films that we've seen. And yet so much of the film is him trying to get to the stadium for this last like pennant clinching game.
And especially considering that like the main part of the movie, in a way, the main part of the story is in a montage in which the Tigers end up tying the Orioles. Like, this is a lot of games. We know because Billy crosses off number 19 on the countdown of games that they need to win and ends up by writing one. Like, that's the number of games that they needed to win, not even the number of games included in that montage.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's at least 25 games if they're cleaning up. So we spend 25 minutes on this journey to get to the stadium, and we spend like 3 minutes on the moment, on the exciting moment when like the Tigers are winning all of their games.
Yeah, it's so weird. And there's that moment, like he's like trying to catch buses, the bully comes, takes his money away so he doesn't have bus fare. He's in a bind. Look, I'm not trying to make light of this. He is in a real bind, but he is not able to catch the bus. He misses a bus, and then like he runs along, and then he comes across a little girl.
I was going to say, is this about the little girl with the bicycle?
It's so weird. He like tries to barter for the bike, which is a strange thing to begin with, that any child would be like, I am going to entertain giving a strange child my bike for any reason at all. But he's like, I'll give you my hat. And she's like, I don't want the hat. And he's like, what about my watch? And she's like, I've already got a watch. And then he's like, what about my belt?
Yes.
And this little girl is like, now we're talking.
Yes. Yes.
What?
Why would the little girl want the belt, but not the watch? Like,
or the hat. Or like all three. Give me all of them. I'm still losing on the deal.
I mean, in what world is a belt a fair trade for a bicycle? I thought that perhaps the theory was that he is going to return the bicycle. He says that he's going to.
He
does say this, although I am very concerned about that, how that is going to happen. given that he abandons the bicycle by the side of the road.
The second he sees another bus.
Presumably miles from where the girl was like toddling along the sidewalk.
Yeah, and he doesn't know where she lives. She's a stranger.
But if we accept that the belt was just like a rental fee for the bicycle, not a straight up trade, why does she want the belt and not the watch? I mean, for resale value alone.
Look, if you're taking collateral, you got to get the high value thing.
Yes.
That's just like a fact.
Yeah.
And like, what a dirtbag move to be like, I'm taking this bike. And then the minute he sees another bus, he just like throws it.
Yeah.
And runs into the bus and then doesn't even get onto the bus. And rather than being like, I guess I'll go back to the bike, he climbs onto the back of the bus, which like arguably he could have done with the first bus.
What I had exactly the same thought. I was like, why didn't you just do that to begin with and not steal this poor girl's bike?
I mean, I guess she's got a belt. I hope it was a nice, maybe it was a nice belt and we just couldn't see it.
Yeah, but I mean, the only answer that I can think of for why she would want the belt and not the watch that doesn't trouble me is that she just wants to like incorporate a more masculine fashion sense into her wardrobe, which like it doesn't particularly seem like that's what she's rolling with when we see her. But you know what? Like, number one, people change and like maybe her mom won't buy her the tomboy clothes that she wants. But like every other scenario about why she would want the belt and not the watch is very troubling.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
Yes. I feel like it's keeping me up at night. This little girl, the girl and the belt and the watch. It almost feels like some sort of a riddle that you're supposed to solve.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the farmer with like the fox and the chicken and the bag of grain.
Like, this is also explaining why you've been like rolling around in your sleep being like, not the belt, not the belt.
Yeah. That's exactly why. Oh, I'm glad I could answer.
At first I was like, maybe this isn't related.
Childhood trauma question mark.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I think I'm going to generously give a 40 here.
I don't know, man.
Just because it like it still like it moves along, and even though it is weird and some moments are longer than they should be, like where I still felt like, oh well, this is not great, but at least we're sort of in and out. Like if I were in my old ways, I'd want to give this like, you know, probably like a 35.
Yeah, yeah. No, actually, like this movie is full of things that I want to give a 35 to.
But I'll go 40, whatever.
I'm going to go 30.
All right.
But the thing is, it's a not miserable 30.
And exactly. That's why, I think like, that's part of my...
I almost want to give it a 40 for being like... But I actually didn't hate watching it.
Yeah.
I was far less miserable rewatching this movie than I was rewatching Summer Catch. But like, if I just look at the editing and the directing and the writing of this thing, it is not good.
But I do think that like how you feel watching it is a part of the storytelling.
It is a part of the storytelling. Like, it definitely should be a factor.
So that is the thing that ultimately, like, bumps it up for me. But I respect your 30 and...
Yeah, I think I'm going to stick with 30.
Neither of us is going to be doing, like, for your consideration ads for this.
No, probably not. It would be rather belated.
Yeah.
But we won't be doing them anyway. And so, our next tool is the score tool.
Score tool!
Oh, golly. This score is all over the place.
Bonkers, bonkers, banana town.
Yes. Yes.
Tiger town. More like banana town.
Exactly. Yeah. Why is this banana town? I was told this would be Tiger town. Rawr. So I like the jazzy music in the credits, but it doesn't totally fit the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie uses Take Me Out to the Ball Game more than Ken Burns Baseball does.
Oh my God. It's, yeah, like several times.
Yes. And my absolute least favorite version is the weird rendition when he sneaks into the clubhouse.
The like haunted amusement park
yes, version. Yes, absolutely the haunted amusement park version. That is my least favorite Take Me Out to the Ball Game rendition, to be clear. I think the most baffling score moment in general is the like Ren Fair music when he's going home to discover that his dad has died.
Mm.
what is happening with that choice?
It's so strange. It's so, so strange.
Yeah, it is a total Ren Faire, like, oh my gosh, like you expect there to be like turkey legs being served or something.
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah. Or like Eric Idle to like hop out. Like it's almost a little bit like send up of Ren Faire music.
Yeah. Is there a joust?
Yeah, exactly. What's going to happen now?
Sorry, your dad's dead. The Black Knight killed him.
The Black Knight killed him. Exactly. Yes. Yes. Don't eat the soup or you might have food poisoning. I think maybe my favorite is actually the drum solo style for his long track to Tiger Stadium. Very long, though it may be. It kind of reminded me of my dance improv class in college.
Oh, it reminded me of like Birdman.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah, or Birdman, which is also actually a positive association.
Yeah, very like hi-hat heavy, like ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch, like as he's running to a couple of buses and negotiating the bicycle that we have talked about before.
Talked about it greatly. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a 40.
I am actually going in the other direction. I'm going to give it a 55.
What?
Just because I appreciated how weird it was. I was like, if this is going to baffle me, at least it's going to do so in an entertaining way.
That's
and
true.
That put it actually like weirdly above average for me. I also appreciated that they had Mary Wilson of the Supremes doing the national anthem for that last game. I thought that was very, very cool. Yeah, I don't know that I have a lot to say that we have not already mentioned. It's really just that in this very perplexing at times film, this was like good perplexing for me. So yeah, I'm going to go 55. I'm not saying that I suggest it to be your score, that it's even a good idea to score it that way.
No,
Maybe it's reckless.
I think I'm going to stick with 40. But like I could see going 45 because again, I don't think... With the exception of the haunted amusement park, take me out to the ball game, I don't think that there's any moment that detracted from my enjoyment of the film at that moment.
Yeah.
I mean, there were things that I was definitely like, what is up with this choice? But I wasn't made angry.
Yeah.
And or aggrieved.
There were also like moments of the score that didn't like quite make sense, but had like a kind of 70s American film vibe to them. Like I felt like I was watching like a Scorsese film from the 70s or something that like I kind of appreciated. Not because it like helped the film necessarily, but just because the warm feeling that I get when I hear like a score from an American film from the 1970s. So this is a score that is inflated and probably not deserved, but it's just reflecting how I felt.
Yeah, I just feel like your scouting director is going to be like, wait, what is up with this, Eric? But you know what? You're going to have to wear it.
Yep.
Go get 'em, Tiger.
We're all behind our baseball team. Go get 'em, Tigers.
So, what do you think about acting?
Honestly, most of the weight here falls on the shoulders of Justin Henry,
indeed,
who plays Alex.
The small shoulders.
And what I will say is that a movie starring a little kid, in a lot of ways, it's going to live or die based on whether or not this kid has any skill and or whether or not this kid is super annoying. Mm. And frankly, I think this kid's pretty good. I don't find him to be especially annoying. He's not like a wunderkind of acting, but I think that like he's not bad. And I think that this is a film that, like, the role as written could have, like, very easily been, like, unbearable.
Terrible. Yes, unwatchable.
And I don't think that he is.
Yeah.
Otherwise, like, you've got Roy Scheider, who's great, but, like, he's kind of separate from everything.
It's almost barely even an acting role.
Yeah.
It feels like he's in two scenes with dialogue.
Yeah, like, he's not phoning it in, but the movie doesn't really ask a lot of him. And aside from just being like the kind of thing that he could do in his sleep, like, I wonder what his shooting schedule was.
I also thought about that. I was like, I wonder how many days of this film actually he was even with the company.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? If it was like, we're gonna knock out Mr. Scheider's like filming in 4 days or something, I would totally believe that.
Yeah, it feels like this is the kind of thing that shot for like whatever, 3 or 4 weeks, and that he was there for like a week of it doing his stuff, and maybe even some of those days were not long days.
Yeah. I, you know, it's interesting because I feel like what I had sort of received from Justin Henry is that like a 50 grade young adult actor, like he's fine, but I think perhaps actually he's a 55. I think maybe a 50 grade young adult actor is slightly more annoying than he is.
Yeah. And there are a couple of scenes that are like kind of difficult for a kid, like crying at the dad's funeral. And he's got a couple of like quiet moments, like with his mom, where they're like talking about like going to the last game and like, you're not going to skip school. No. We've got an early day that like is subtle in a way that like I would not just expect any child actor to do. Like, I think he does an above average job.
Yeah. And I feel like some of those scenes with the mom though are really terrible. And it's like at least 63% how terrible the dialogue is.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like it's some of the worst acting from lead actors we have received on this podcast.
Okay.
Like the scene where she's like, you can't cut school. And then also the scene where she comes up to his room and it's like, what's going on? Those two scenes, I was like, oh God, this acting, like the acting that I am receiving at this moment is no better than a 40.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, all in all, I think I'm like a 50. I think that he's good. I mean, I almost was a 55 just because like, I think it ultimately has to do with how good the kid is. And I think that the supporting performances are like mostly pretty good. I don't think that any of them are great. I don't think that any of them are like so bad that I want to call attention to them. I think it's fine. I'm just going to say 50. I think it's fine.
I was going to go 45, but I think I'm going to go 50 upon consideration of your argument that I think is right, that Justin Henry is actually definitely at least a 55 young adult actor.
Yeah.
And really, yes, mostly carries the film. So 50 for me. So the next tool is delightfulness of Ketra character, and there isn't really a Ketra character. I sort of feel like the film is trying to posit that Alex fills the catcher function in this film, but I don't think that even remotely counts. So 20.
20. Yep.
Yep. What about delightfulness of announcer?
Well, you know, we do get real life folks, Ernie Harwell and Al Ackerman, and they do a pretty good job all in all. They set the table with the exposition. They're like, Billy Young has been bad. Does he have time left to be good? And, you know, the Tigers have been bad. Will they be bad this time also? But, you know, it's a little simple. It's very like a Disney family film, even though this was like kind of the first, at least for the Disney Channel. I don't know. There's not a lot of complexity. They do their job, but there's nothing that impressive about it. There are a couple of things that are a little bit like, well, that seems like a strange thing to say at this moment. Like when Billy gets hit in the head by a pitch and one of them says, I don't know if he's conscious or unconscious. And he's like writhing on the ground.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Come on.
He's conscious. He's moving around.
I do like their disappointment at the Tigers fans booing Billy. You know, like I feel like, you know, booing your own team is something to lament. And I like that that is there. I don't know. I think I'm a 45.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I think I'm a little swayed by the fact that Ernie Harwell, even though he is sort of, he's in the booth with Ray Lane, which they worked together for a number of years, from 1967 to 1972, it was not the person that Harwell was working with most of the time when he was with the Tigers. But just like the fact that Ernie Harwell is sort of an all-time great, like he's in the Hall of Fame for the National Sportscasters and Sports Writers Association and the Hall of Fame for the American Sportscasters Association, and also has won baseball's Hall of Fame Ford C. Frick Award. Like,
yeah, no, that's true.
To me, like, I don't feel like Ernie is quite allowed to be himself in the way that, like, for example, Vin Scully is in For the Love of the Game. So I feel like we do not receive more than a 55 grade delight from this movie, but
I think that's why my score, I feel like, is low, is that I feel like it's him, but it's not him.
Yeah, but I think I'm still going to go 55.
All right.
And I would just like to share my favorite fact is that when then Tigers president, and I might be mispronouncing this person's name, Bo Schembechler, unceremoniously let Harwell go in 1991 after 31 years on the Tigers broadcast crew. People were so incensed that there were threats of violence, and other people, probably not the same people, these seem like different coping mechanisms, other people bought billboards advocating for Harwell to remain. But he was brought back in 1993 when Mike Ilitch bought the Tigers. So.
That's amazing.
Yes, that's my fun Ernie Harwell fact. So our final tool is lack of misogyny. And this, I mean, it could be worse. But it's also not good.
No.
Like, both of the female characters in this movie get kind of a raw deal. I mean, yeah. We have discussed that little girl is never going to get her bike back.
Yeah. And also, just the fact that you're like both of the female characters in this
right.
film.
Yes. I mean, that is part of the problem. But there aren't actually a ton of characters in this film.
It's true.
In general. So, definitely, I was like, there's only two women. And then I was like, yeah, but there's like five people who are real characters in general. So, that's not an exact number. That's an emotional number.
I did really like how the mom wakes Alex up by like doing the national anthem like at the beginning of a ball game. I thought that was like a fun little touch and a nice little character detail that shows you that she is like a loving and smart person.
Yes.
I thought that was like actually a good little bit of storytelling.
I thought it was a good bit of storytelling all around because I was like, consider this. This child has a record of the Star Spangled Banner.
Yeah.
And like, that's an important fact, I feel like, to know how much of a nerd he is. Because then we subsequently see him being teased for liking sports, which is like, you know,
what a weird thing to.
Something that kids get teased for all the time. Like, you're too much of a jock. Like, get out of here yeah. with your liking sports stuff. Anyway.
Get out of here. We're about to play Dungeons and Dragons.
Exactly.
Nerd. Sports nerd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
However, I mean, we already discussed a little bit the disparaging of mom's mac and cheese, and I was just kind of thinking like, well, let's see the food that you make, yeah. dad and yeah. child. And I also feel like, and I feel this from a storytelling perspective as well as a misogyny perspective, but I was like, I can go ahead and just talk about this here. I feel like any more character development for the mom character who does not have a name.
No. Or a job, apparently.
Yeah. Well, might have been a good B plot for the movie. Like, is she working? Was she not working before, but she has to work now that, like, his father is dead? Is she having a hard time getting out of bed now? Like, is she depressed? I actually feel like expansion on any of these things would have been a more interesting backdrop for Alex's fixation yeah. on Billy Young.
Yeah.
Like, it would have strengthened all of the other elements of the movie. And instead, there's just, like, as I talked about, there's just a complete lack of clarity around the storyline that she does have. Like,
yeah.
what is her perspective? She's like smiling and looking wistfully at his baseball notes. Is she not upset that he's missing school?
It's inexplicable.
Yes. So, I don't know, 40.
I'm also a 40. The other thing that I'm just going to mention, and it's not exactly lack of misogyny, but this seemed like as good a place as any to mention it. Alex's teacher. What's going on there? This is like, so there is a scene in the film where we see Alex in a classroom and there's a teacher who is reading from some book. I have no idea what kind of a class this is. I was like, is this English class? Is this like, who knows what it is? She is reading from a book, except it seems like she barely is able even to read.
Indeed.
It's inexplicable. And all that I left that scene with was the thought of like, why should Alex even be at school if this is what his teacher is like? Like, I wouldn't want to be in that classroom either.
Yeah.
So yeah, 40.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I didn't get to it in storytelling, but I had definitely taken the note, like, W.T. Fork, is the teacher reading? Like, what is this subject? What is happening here? I mean, you're the only one of us who at one point in your life went to a Detroit public school, but like, I mean, it's a stunning indictment on the education system in general.
Well, let me just say that all of my teachers there were able to read.
Good. I'm relieved.
Yeah. I'll stand behind that. Yeah.
Ah. So on that note, let's move along to our next segment. Yes or no? Would this movie be better with Kevin Costner in it?
I think so. I mean, he could play Billy Young, of course, and that would be fine and dandy. But he also could be pretty good as Mr. Alex's dad. I think that could be fine. I don't quite get why they do the, like, slovenly blue-collar thing for the dad, like, when they live in a big house and money doesn't seem to be a factor, even though he's out of a job and looking for a job.
And his mom is also like kind of a dish.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, in comparison.
And I don't know, like there's something nice about casting Costner as like a baseball dad, you know, especially given like Field of Dreams and all of that. But like, I think also it would be awesome to have Kevin Costner in the film as young Billy Chappell from For Love of the Game, who in that movie is key to the success of the 1984 Tigers and the World Series. So, like, let's link these universes.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be good. Yeah. I mean, my answer was just like, yes, like, Kevin Costner is everyone in this movie. Kevin Costner is Billy Young, as the dad, as child Alex. Like, let's do Tiger Town being Kevin Costner.
Yeah, for
sure.
Let's
do it. Does this movie reference Babe Ruth?
I mean, sort of.
I think the pictures in the credits count.
Yeah, in the opening montage, there are a couple of photos of the babe, which, you know, it skews like Detroit heavy for all of the obvious and appropriate reasons. But there are photos of just kind of like general baseball legendary people also. And Babe Ruth is among them and appears in a couple of photos. So, yeah, there is Babe Ruth in this film.
It counts. Is there a dog?
Am I losing my mind, or is this a Disney film starring a little kid that doesn't have a frickin' pooch in it?
There's no dog. There's not even a picture of a dog.
Like, and there needs to be, right?
There does.
Like, yep. Maybe even like a smarter than a normal dog that like helps Alex get into the stadium or something.
Yes.
Or like beats up the bully or like something. But instead of that, we get no dog, just like empty space where a dog should be.
Yep. Yep. All of that B-roll footage would have been a lot better if there'd been a dog in it.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't even have to be a dog character. It can just be, like, random dog.
Yeah.
Are Yankees fans the main antagonist of this film?
No, I don't think so. Like, mortality?
That's exactly what I wrote. I mean, like, if any franchise, Orioles fans, but obviously Orioles fans are not an issue. So, yeah, the main antagonist is the bully kid.
Yeah.
And mortality.
Although, the New York Yankees began as like the original Orioles moved to New York. It's a very complicated historical thing that it's not worth getting into right now, but there is a connection between a version of the Baltimore Orioles and the New York Yankees. And although those Orioles are not affiliated with the Orioles that we see in this film, which would be more affiliated with the St. Louis Browns, one could make a case.
I'm here for it. Yeah. I appreciate you. Yes, thank you. Thank you. What about 6 degrees of baseball?
There were actually a couple of options here, and I was surprised by that. There's a Roy Scheider one that I'm just going to like hang on to for nice. The time. But in the meantime, I'm going to say that Ron McLarty, who plays Buddy, that's the name of Alex's dad. I don't think we ever hear it.
Oh, wow.
But that is what it, the role is credited as in
also,
IMDb.
Ron McClarty is the name of a person.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to pick this because he does the voice of Papa Bear in the Berenstain Bears Play Ball.
Oh, my goodness. That's the most perfect thing that it could possibly have been.
Isn't it
that
great?
Yes, that is absolutely. Oh, my gosh. Yes.
Coming soon to take me into the ball game. Oh, maybe, not that soon, but,
yeah, maybe not that
but
soon,
but maybe sometime.
Oh, Lord. What was your favorite moment of this film?
I don't know. Maybe this is a cop-out. I just really liked seeing all the footage from, like, Detroit of this era. I liked seeing shots of the city. I liked seeing also just, like, culturally, I liked seeing, like, the ways that, like, the hot dogs were being passed back and forth and the money getting passed back and forth. And I know that, like, that kind of stuff, like, still happens, but it feels like not quite in the same way. And I just liked the ways in which this film sort of felt like a time capsule.
Mm-hmm. I have three moments, and one of them is the passing the hot dog shot.
Nice!
Yes. And my other two moments are when the bully kid starts dancing to the radio.
I can't believe we haven't talked about that. Yes, that's incredible. That's a very good choice.
It's so good. It's so good. And then also...
Wait. But, like, just for people who haven't seen this film, there is a moment before or in the midst of this, like, incredibly long journey of Alex trying to get to the stadium for this big last game where this bully in this, like, very, like, fancy, kind of old-timey, but kind of, like, new for 1983, like, sort of, like, newsboy cap. He and his goons pin Alex to a fence, steal his money, and, like...
And also his radio.
And his radio. And rather than having the game on, turns it to, like, a station and to, like, show his, like, victory over Alex and also, like, demean him, turns it to, like, a music station and like, does, like, dancing to him. It's amazing. It's so weird.
Yeah. Also, like, the particular kind of dancing.
Yeah.
Is, I almost can't describe it.
Yeah. It's too beautiful. They should have sent a poet.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I've only published one book of poetry, so I'm not qualified to describe this child dancing. So my last moment is when Alex blazes through on the bike and makes all the elderly women drop their groceries.
Solid choice.
And the fact that, like, two of my three favorite moments are, like, yeah, when the bully kid steals the radio and does a dance, and, like, when Alex makes all the old ladies drop their groceries, I was like, I am a jerk. Maybe it's just my mood. Yeah.
Solid choices.
What about your least favorite moment?
Oh, dude, it takes forever for him to get to the stadium at the end. This is not a long movie, and too much of it is Alex trying to get to that decisive game. So, like, it's that. Ultimately, like, that whole thing, like, cut it down to, like, 3 or 4 minutes instead of what it is, which is, again, like, I feel like it's, like, almost a quarter of the film.
Yeah, well, I had this real question about, like, how many days of shooting
Justin
Henry either, like, riding a bike or running? Like, it feels like a good 15-20% of the film. And I was thinking, like, were there rules for minors on films the same in the 80s as they are today? Like... It seems tough.
Yeah. Make that shorter. Use that time to show the mom earning a living, being a badass single parent, like anything else. So for that reason, I'm going to pick that last sequence. There's stuff to like in that last sequence, and we've talked about it, but on the whole, it is way too long, and that is why it is my choice.
Yeah. For me, my least favorite moment is the scene where Alex's mom confronts him about missing school.
Mm-hmm.
The dialogue is so, so awful, and the storytelling is so unclear, and it's all freaking stupid because there were no weekday games anyway. So.
There you go.
It seems like you maybe already started to get into this, and we might have a kind of a similar answer here. So what's the scene that you would like to see?
fill out the mom stuff, like I said earlier, and or maybe a bit more of Billy Young, a little more not just Roy Scheider, like working separately from everybody else to fill out this role of a star who is kind of separate from the rest of the movie. Maybe a little bit more of the dad before he just like suddenly dies. Like all of these things just feel very rushed. And I think the movie would be better if they had like expanded on any of those things.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I feel like this movie needs to be entirely rearranged. Mm-hmm. We can get rid of a lot of stuff. We don't need to just add a scene. But like we could have a scene where his mom comes in tired from her new job.
Yeah.
And Billy's watching the Tigers on TV and she says, you know who I've always liked on this team? I've liked that catcher, whatever the catcher's name is. Like, can you wish for him too? And then we get to see the catcher character. And also Alex's praying is more generous and it makes more sense that the Tigers won that many games if Billy Young only got 47 RBI.
Yeah.
My scene is trying to solve so many of the problems.
No, but that makes sense. So, dreamiest player, it's kind of like a short list of candidates, because like, are there players aside from Billy, really?
I don't think there really are.
Yeah.
I don't think that there are other players in this universe, and so I'm going to say Billy Young.
Yeah. I mean, hey, I'm a Roy Scheider stan for sure, but like, dreamy is not necessarily the word that I would first choose for him.
Yes, but if there's only one.
Yeah. And you could do worse.
Yeah.
For sure.
Not bad. So, who had your favorite performance?
I'm just going to go ahead and say Justin Henry. Like, he's a child performer in a Disney film, and I didn't roll my eyes in disdain throughout the whole thing. And problems that I had, like, with the film were certainly not because of him. And he also had some nice moments. So, sure. I'll go with him.
Excellent. In honor and deference to Roy Scheider, I pick Roy Scheider.
Nice.
He's an amazing actor and he's doing just fine here.
Yeah.
Yes. It's about all that needs to be said about that. And mm-hmm. So that concludes
our episode
of Tiger Town.
You are now leaving Tiger Town.
You are now leaving Banana Town, Tiger Town. And if you enjoyed this podcast, we would very much appreciate you giving us a 5-star rating and a review on iTunes. That's the place to do it. If you find other places to do it, go ahead and do it there.
I loved your uncertainty there.
Yes, indeed. We would like to thank B-Scope for their review. Great idea. What a fun show. Awesome.
Wonderful.
Concise.
Love it.
Yes. Appreciated it very much. And next time, we are going to be talking for all of you St. Louis Cardinals fans who, I mean, by the time that you're listening to this podcast, will know whether or not your team is in the playoffs as it seems like you're going to be now again. We are going to be doing the Pride of St. Louis.
Yeah, get that Dizzy Dean action.
What? And if you would
the
like...
The Pride of St. Louis. Throwback to our second episode.
Our second episode, The Pride of the Yankees, when Eric and maybe even I both said The Pride of the Yankees.
The Pride
for some reason,
of the Yankees.
Completely inexplicable to us. So if you would like to find us on the internet between now and then, my...
Good luck.
Yeah, there's only like 5 different places. You can find me on Twitter at Ellen_Adair or on Instagram at EllenAdairG or at EllenDrawsBaseball. You can also email me at EllenDrawsBaseball@gmail.com and request a commission for a drawing of a baseball thing or another thing.
And I am at Eric Gildy on both of those things. I am no longer taking drawing commissions because nobody respects my talents.
I thought you were just totally full up. You're like booked through the holidays.
It's true. I'm just...
So many people asked you to draw a baseball cat when you offered to draw a baseball cat.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm swamped. I'm swamped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so on that note, we will swamp you next time on Take Me Into the Ball Game.
Bye, guys.
It's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game.